It's the 12th, yeah, 12th of April, and we have an exam coming up on Tuesday. So it's going to be on bonds. Boring bonds. Make sure you understand bonds. The bond calculations that we did from Chapter 10, you can bring your formula sheet, you know, but yeah, I'll have extras. And then some calculations from Chapter 6, the constant perpetual growth model, the dividend earnings model, cash discounted cash flows. And then what we're going to do today, Chapter 11, Diversification, Asset Allocation. Also, today I'm going to change my office hours because I have giving a little seminar down at Otay Mesa at 3:30. So I'm going to, instead of having an office hour from 2:30 to 3:20, which I usually do, which nobody comes to. Actually, Jaime comes every Wednesday, but he's not here. Yeah, Wesley comes. You usually come on Mondays and Wednesdays, though, don't you? Yeah, you usually come on Mondays and Wednesdays. So I'll be here from 11 to 12, which I'm usually here anyway, but I don't like to make it office hour then because that's the college hour, and I like to, sometimes we have meetings and the like. So Baba's sticking around. So if you want to stick around right after class, I'll be here. Normally it's on Thursdays from 1:30 to 3:30, but now it'll only be 1:30 to 2:30. Okay? But I'll stick around after class, which I usually do anyway, unless I've got a stupid meeting to go do. So we're going to try to tie all this stuff together, and I sure hope it makes sense. But first, let's see. Hey, we're back up to 8%. You like the bungee jumping the market does every once in a while? Does it unnerve you? Yeah? Get used to it. That's the way we're going to learn about shorting in a couple of weeks, and after we do stock options, and that's what happens when the market starts to go down. Certain people pile on and they knock the market down even further. But then what usually happens is it bounces back because it's like a spring being compressed. So how are we doing, huh? 50% Apple. And you go look at the PE Apple, it's what, 17? It's not that bad. And they're going to pay dividends? But Netflix, I guess we should have sold Netflix. Do you want to sell anything? Only got 5 million weeks. No, just hang on. Okay, all right. What? Coca-Cola. Yeah, I know. You don't sell Coca-Cola. It can't, yeah, you just leave it there. People... Oh, okay, good. Okay. There you go. Okay, so we need a good joke. Anybody got a good joke? No? No, I only have bad jokes. Did I tell you? We've been doing Battle of the Sexes jokes, and there's these jokes from the Midwest. They're called Lena and Ole jokes. Lena and Ole, have you ever heard them? They're from Norway, Lena and Ole. They live in Minnesota now, though. And when you tell Californians these jokes, they kind of look at you and you say, do they really laugh at those? Yes, the Midwesterners, they love those jokes. So Lena and Ole have been married a long time, don't you know? And so they drive each other absolutely crazy. But Ole goes up to Lena one night and he says, Lena, I've been watching those Bob Dole commercials, don't you know? And I've been taking a spoonful of Vigoro every day for the last 3 weeks. Have you noticed the difference? And she looked at him and said, you old fool, there's Viagra on the television. Vigoro is the plant food I use on the plants in the house. And he said, oh, plant food. That explains the berries. Yeah, anyway, so he went to the doctor and he got the Vigoro, right? He got the Viagra. And he took the Viagra and he turned down the lights and he lit a candle and he poured a bottle of wine. He said, Lena, tonight I'm going to make you the happiest woman in the world. And she said, good, when are you leaving? They keep going. They don't stop. It got stuck in his throat. The Viagra gave him a stiff neck. It actually, believe it or not, it doesn't end. They just keep pounding the jokes and they laugh. No. Midwest. I'll tell you some more Lena and Ole jokes later. A racy joke? That's about as close as racy as you're going to get. Diversification and risky asset allocation. And when we take a look at this, folks, we are basically pulling it all together. Because in reality, we're done. I mean, really, for the vast majority of investors, we've gone through the major asset allocations, major asset classes, and we're going to learn about stock options and shorting and margining and a few other things, but those are not as important for the vast majority of investors. Some of you might get into those things. Uh-oh, what's going on here? Hello? Here we go. You've heard the term diversification. Well, we discussed it quite a bit when we talked about mutual funds. Spreading your investments across a number of asset classes to eliminate some, but not all, of the risks of investing. Have you heard the saying, don't put all your eggs in one basket? Mm-hmm. That's the idea, right? But other people say, oh, no, put all your eggs in one basket, and watch that basket. It's attributed to Mark Twain, probably erroneously. Would you want to do that? Would you want to bet everything on one stock or one? Yeah, okay. Diversification has been one of the best methods to reduce risk. Here are several asset categories: large company U.S. stocks, global small company stocks, international outside the United States, emerging markets, U.S. bonds, and international bonds, and lastly, cash. And what you see, I don't know if you can tell, but the blue areas are the years in which that asset class won, basically, did the best. And what you notice is that never, not once, did cash win. Now, many others had negative years. Cash never has a negative year. A couple of years, a few years, it's been nothing. But it's only been a few times, the late 90s, when large company stocks in the U.S. were on top. Global small company stocks, only once. But look at the variation. 51%, minus 43%. 30%, minus 11. 51. You know, variance, right? Emerging markets. Look at the one who's been the winner over the last 25 years the most. China, Philippines, Mexico, India, Turkey, Peru, Brazil, Russia, the Eastern European countries. But one negative 53% year does what to your portfolio? Knocks it in half. So you've built it all the way up to $200,000 in 1 year, boom, it's down to $100,000. But the next year, 80%. And then bonds, a few times, and international bonds a few times. So diversification means spreading out the risk. And diversification has the wonderful distinction that something in your portfolio will do badly. Every year, you get this wonderful warm feeling that there's going to be something that's going to stink. But there's going to be something that should hold up well. Except for 2008, where the only thing that held up were bonds, and these are mostly government bonds that held up. The other bonds, corporate bonds, muni bonds, those got hammered too. Questions, comments, thoughts? What's the takeaway? Anybody? What do you think? Yeah, that's the idea, isn't it? That's the idea. The idea is to spread out your assets.
Lower your risk, you also lower your potential.
That, right? You can't get away from that, isn't it? The more the return you want, the more risk you're going to have to take. The less risk you want, the less return you're going to get. But, did you want to say something?
No,
I'm sorry.
No, it's just that, like, one of my neighbors back in 2008, from senior citizen, was walking his dog. You'd be yapping about how much money he lost in the stock market. And I'm thinking about what you just said, diversification. Maybe the guy didn't
diversify enough. How old was he? Is he in his
70s?
70s,
yeah.
Yeah, he really should have a lot of bonds, shouldn't he? In your 70s, you should have a lot of bonds. And we're going to take a look at the old adage of how much bonds you should have, and we'll discuss that in a bit. But we come back to the exact same problem we had at the beginning of the semester. How do you measure risk? There's no perfect measurement for risk. Way back in chapter 1, we introduced the tug of war between risk and return. We saw how higher the average annual return, the higher the standard deviation and its companion measurement variance from the average annual return. So we saw who did the best, the emerging markets, but oh boy, minus 50, up 70, up the dude. We studied the major financial asset classes, mutual funds, stocks, bonds, cash. We discussed the risks and returns of each. Return is easy to measure, folks. How much money did you start with? How much did you make? That's your return. But risk is very difficult to measure, and it's even harder to anticipate. Witness 2008, where everybody went down. I think you already saw it, yeah. So, variance and its more useful companion, standard deviation, tell us how much an asset class will vary from the expected return. Those numbers are readily available in Chapter 1. They wanted you to learn how to compute them, but I don't care. You just look them up. And the numbers ain't pretty, folks. Yes?
I don't think we should
run all the way around. Well, okay. If you weren't here, you saw them. Did you see it? It hasn't changed. It's the same one from last week, from the week before. It's just some people hadn't seen it yet. The numbers aren't pretty. For any randomly selected stock on the New York Stock Exchange, the standard deviation is almost 50%. You just pick a stock on the New York Stock Exchange. 50% up and down from its average annual return. That means in any one year, many stocks on the New York Stock Exchange will vary up or down close to 50% from their average annual return. These are the most stable stocks, supposedly. Now on the NASDAQ, there's some that are just as stable. So how do we reduce the variance? In other words, how do we reduce the risk as measured by standard deviation? The answer, of course, is to diversify. If we go from one randomly selected stock using the dartboard and go to two, the standard deviation goes down from 49% to 36. So it went from 50% almost down to 38%, 36, 7%. If we pick 10 stocks, it goes down to almost 24. 20, 21.68, and so on, and so on. Diversifying our stock portfolio reduces our risk substantially, as measured by reduced variance and standard deviation. Does this make sense? Am I talking just, what are we talking about, Bayana? Because I don't want to make it worse. I'm trying to clarify what's going on. So here's a table from the book. They are adding stocks in our portfolio. 1 to 2 to 4 to 6 to 8. Stop. Put it in your pocket. Put it in your pocket. Thank you very much. Stop crinkling. Put it away, please. Yeah. Put it away. And we see the average standard deviation going down. Well, now, wait a minute. What's happening here? We went from 1 to 2, 49 to 37, 29, 21, 30, 46, 20, 50, 90. What's happening? The more stocks we add, the smaller and smaller the increment, isn't it? And there's a limit. And some of you might know limits from math and you hated them and there's good reason. But they are useful. There is a limit to how much risk we can reduce by using diversification. In any given asset class, in this case we're just talking about stocks. So you see, it goes down quickly as we add stocks, but then when we start to add more and more and more stocks, it doesn't go down any further. Or it goes down very, very, very small. Are you with me? Understand? Okay, and why? Yes?
Exactly, you approach the average of the marketplace.
Exactly. You're becoming the marketplace. And why does that answer the question? Well, it's called correlation. Correlation. Did I spell it right? Yes, I think I did. Correlation. The tendency of the returns of two assets to move together. So stocks tend to move together because they're tied to the economy, and the economy moves in certain ways. Imperfect correlation is the reason that diversification works, because no two investment returns will be exactly the same. when items are in lockstep with one another, they move together, we call that, I'm going to use green for that. Did I bring out, orange or red. When items tend to move together, they are called positively correlated. And when items tend to move in opposite directions, they are called negatively correlated. When they move apart from one another. And this sounds highfalutin, but it's really not that difficult. What we can measure, it's called R. The correlation coefficient. The measure of how closely returns on assets move together. If things are positively, perfectly correlated, then the R coefficient will be 1, or 100%. That means if this one stock moves up, the other stock will move up. And if this stock moves down, the other stock will move down. In lockstep with one another. So they would have a 100% correlation. If they are completely uncorrelated, if one moves up, the other moves down, the other moves down, the other moves up, that would be 100% negative correlation. So I should use there's a plus sign up here, and there's a negative sign here. And if it's zero, it's called neutral or uncorrelated. Exactly. We'll see the next slide. It shows that they don't go up the same amount. They just go up at the same time. They're still considered positive. Here it is. There's the next slide. These two stocks have a perfect positive correlation. One goes up a lot higher than the other one, but they both go up at the same time. Then they both go down at the same time. They're in, we say, lockstep with one another. Right? They're perfectly positively correlated, 100%. Now, they don't have to be 100%. I mean, as long as the one went up, the other one went up, and then the other one went down a little bit, then that number would be less than 100%. But this is pure. And then these two are exactly opposite of one another. They are negative 100% or negative 1. It's the same number. This one goes up, that one went down. That one went down, that one went up. And then this is not the best. I don't like this so much. But it's trying to show you that the two have nothing to do with one another. That would be zero. One went up, the other one stayed the same, or went up with it, or went down. And then the other one went down, the other one went up, or down, or... Yeah, I know, this is not a good picture. But what they're trying to show you in this picture is that the two don't go together. One goes up...
With the zero correlation one, it'd be like if one stock went up, the other one didn't do anything.
Or went down. Or maybe it went up. Exactly. The one went up, the other one sort of stayed the same. And the other one went down, the other one went down with it. And then next time it went up. You understand? There's no correlation. You see, that's the idea. And the picture doesn't really do a good job, does it?
The
second one is negative 100%. Because if this one goes up, this one goes down. This one is supposed to, it's not doing a good job because it kind of looks like they're following one another, doesn't it?
Yeah.
If you look at the graph, it kind of looks like deep down, dip. It looks like they're following one another. So it's not a good graph.
Charlie Brown's shirt.
Charlie Brown's shirt, yeah. Yeah, it does look like Charlie Brown's shirt. But just imagine as if they both just moved in random directions to one another. No correlation. That would be zero. Does that make sense?
Yep.
Yeah. Did I lose you, Rosa? Make sense?
It does.
It does? Okay. So the fact that any two stocks, in this case, talking about stocks, but it could be any asset class, have imperfect correlation, that allows us to reduce the risk. Because this doesn't happen, folks. You don't get 100%. You might get 80% or 60%.
Do you think us know how to write correlations? Do you need us to know that kind of formatting?
No. All I want you to know is what it means to be positively correlated, negatively correlated, imperfectly correlated, perfectly correlated. That's all I want you to know. You're not going to do the calculation. You're going to look it up. Part of the assignment for Chapter 11 is go look it up. because if there's a cap, it's statistics. It's statistics, folks, and you'll learn how to do it in the. Yeah, you'll learn how to do it in the statistics class. You don't have to do it. You just go to the internet. Oh, okay, there it is. They'll do it for you. So, how does this answer our question about why diversification can only reduce by so much the risk of owning stocks? Because although stocks are not perfectly correlated, you don't see this. It just doesn't happen. You know, maybe out of the thousands of stocks, two of them will do it. But although stocks are not perfectly correlated, they are positively correlated enough so that in general, stocks tend to move in the same direction. And you intuitively know this. That's why we refer to stock investments as a whole as the stock market. How's the market doing? Because as the market's going up, most stocks are going up. But are all stocks going up? No. You know, any given time, some companies are doing well, others are doing poorly, and others are just chugging along. But we have the ability, because of the positive correlation among stocks, to look at the stock market as a whole and say, how's the market doing? And as Matt said, after you get 1,000 stocks, you are the market, right? Depending on which stock, I mean, there's more than that, but after you load up your portfolio with hundreds and hundreds and thousands of stocks, you're going to basically get the market's return. Unless you happen to be lucky enough to pick the best or unlucky enough to pick the worst. Okay. Darn! Darn! You know, that's still too much risk for me. I think I'm going to stick with bonds. Right? You're a very conservative, risk-averse investor, and you don't like the volatility of stocks. I'm sorry? Right. You don't want to do it. Would you say that again? I'm sorry.
You can't do much of it. It's just like, right? But then,
the
stock,
you
sell it whenever you think
it's good.
Sell it, right?
Well, I'm not exactly sure. You can't do much with the stock market as a whole.
No, when you buy stocks. Oh, no, that's
bonds.
You're right.
That's okay.
Thinking of bonds, you can't do much with them. You just buy them.
Well, you can sell your bonds. But as we said, as we found, most people don't. They just hang on to them. But, and some people hang on to their stocks. They hold their stocks. That one woman who bought 3 shares of Adabet Laboratories, and it turned into $1 million. You know, but she didn't care. She worked there all her life and then retired. And then, oh my God, look what I got. And then she didn't sell it. She never sold it. She donated it. But, what?
She donated it?
She donated it. Well, she died.
Well, was she all right? Did she have family?
No, she had no family. And she, but she, no, she was very, that's the thing.
You, she didn't have a dog.
She didn't have a dog. No, she donated it to some,
she
some,
she
probably
wasn't even that
much. No, there were stocks. It was over, I forget exactly how much. Look it up. Type Abbott Laboratories Secretary. She worked, she was a secretary at Abbott Laboratories starting in the 1920s or something like that. And she bought 3 shares. And just let them sit.
She's the one that donated $20 million to the...
No, it wasn't. It wasn't that much. It wasn't that much. But just type Abbott Laboratories Secretary, 3 shares, and it'll come up. So you're a risk-averse investor. You decide to put all your money into bonds because you don't want the risk of stocks. You will accept the lower return from the bonds in exchange for the lower risk of the bonds. Oops, bad idea. What? Because, like stocks, bonds are positively correlated with themselves. They also will tend to do well and do poorly as a whole. And they are often negatively correlated, but not always, with stocks. When stocks do well, bonds tend to do poorly. Why? The economy is doing well, stocks are doing well. What happens to interest rates when the economy is doing well?
They go down.
They go up. What happens when interest rates go up? Everyone should say bond prices go down. When the economy is doing poorly, what happens to stocks? Wham! They get hammered. What happens to interest rates? They go down, what happens to bond prices? So there's that negative correlation between stocks and bonds. Now, does it always happen? No, in 2008, everybody fell down. Everybody. Stocks, bonds, real estate, oil, everybody, all the commodities, gold, everybody fall down. So it's not a prayer, it's not a perfect world. But for that reason, it makes sense not only to diversify within assets in a certain class, it makes sense to diversify within asset classes. So now here is, again, the imperfect measure of standard deviation. Now, if this makes sense, great, and if it doesn't, don't get too worried about it. But this graph is trying to show you what happens as you go from 100% stocks and then start adding bonds. So your percentage of stocks is going down, your percentage of bonds is going up. You start reducing the risk, and here's the risk on this axis, standard deviation, and here's your return. And you would think that a 100% stock portfolio would have the best return, and you'd be right, historically, but it's also going to have the most risk. Make sense?
Yes.
As you add bonds, you start to see the risk come down, but you also start to see the return come down. And doesn't that make sense?
Yes.
Right, because bonds just don't return as much as stocks. But they're less risky. But then you reach a point of diminishing returns, where as you start to reduce the stocks more and increase the bonds, yes, your return goes down, the return is continuing to go down, but the standard deviation goes up because you lose that negative correlation. Are you with me? The stocks and the bonds are negatively correlated. As you reduced all the stock exposure, now the bonds are positively correlated with themselves. Bonds do well, they all do well. Bonds do poorly, they all do poorly. You with me? And so here's the table of that graph. So if this makes more sense, fine. If it doesn't, my apologies. And I wish they would have used percentages, because they use percentages on the graph, but now they use 1.00. It's a set, 100%, folks. 100% stocks, 0% bonds, expected rate of return 12%, standard deviation 15%. And as we reduce the amount of stocks and raise the amount of bonds, we see the return going down, but we also see the standard deviation going down. And shut up. How do you do it? I just found this thing. I need to shut it up. Okay, there. You see the return continue to go down as you add more and more bonds, right? But as we hit this, where is it, about 70-30 or so? We minimize the standard deviation, but now as we reduce the amount of stocks, the standard deviation starts going back up again because the bonds are correlated with themselves. Make sense? So what does that tell you, folks? See, this is my fear. I confuse the hell out of you. You know? Balance funds. Remember balance funds? That's why they're so popular with people. Providing they're a true balance fund, and the mutual fund manager keeps about 60% stocks, 40% bonds, 50-50. That's why balance funds are very popular with people who are prudent. You know, not rolling the dice. A combination of stocks and bonds actually created a portfolio with less risk as measured imperfectly by standard deviation, while earning you more return than just bonds. If you are seeking less risk, it not only pays to diversify within an asset class, have 20 different stocks or 30 different stocks, it pays to diversify among asset classes, have some stocks and some bonds, and eventually most of you are going to buy a house, so you'll have some real estate, and maybe you want to buy a rental unit, and maybe you want to get involved in commodities. So the same relationship occurs with domestic and foreign stocks and bonds, but not as much as it used to. It used to be 40, 50 years ago, they moved in different cycles. But now the world is global and it's really moving together. That's mostly. Although diversification is still not a guarantee of positive results. No diversification scheme worked well in 2008 unless it happened to be money market and treasury bonds. That was it. If that was your idea of diversification, boy, did you do well in 2008 relative to everybody else. We have a name for choosing the appropriate mix for an investor. It is called asset allocation. And sometimes you will see funds called asset allocation mutual funds. And it doesn't mean that they're actually, you know, balanced funds. You have to be careful. They tend to be lumped together, balanced funds and asset allocation funds. But be careful, because asset allocation mutual funds often, but not always, have a tendency to try to time the market. They think, oh, stocks are going to do well. Let's put 100% in the stocks. Or bonds are going to do well. Let's put 100% in bonds. Or neither. Let's put 100% in cash. That's called market timing. It's very difficult to do. And as we said, the only people who can do it successfully are liars. Asset allocation is a fit. I'm sorry? Liars. Yes. You know there's three types of liars? Liars, damn liars, and statisticians. Well, it's different, but there's liars, damn liars, and lawyers. There's liars, damn liars, and politicians, and then other people. It's the same joke. Liars, damn liars, and statisticians. Anyway, asset allocation.
Statistics or statisticians?
Statisticians. Not estheticians, no. No, statisticians. Statistics.
You take information?
Statistics, yes. No, it's my English. It's my English. Because in Spanish, esthetician conflicts, because they never, well, you know them. You can speak. I like when they say speakers. Speakers. You know, bocinas and speakers. Listen to the speakers. How much should I have in stocks? How much in bonds? How much of each stock or bond? This is where somebody asked this. Many advisors suggest a formula, and this is a tried and true formula that's been used for many decades. It doesn't work anymore. You subtract your age from 100. Okay? 100. What's your age?
18.
Let's say 40. Let's say 40. We did 40 up here, but we'll do 18 next time. That's how much you should have in stocks. 60% stocks and 40% bonds. Are you with me? If you're 18, let's say 20 to make it easy. If you were 20, you should have 80% in stocks and 20% in bonds. Now, you'll notice that it says or 110 or 120. Why are they raising this number? What's going on? People are living longer. See, it made sense when you were 40 years old to have 60-40. And when you were 60 years old to have 40% stocks, 60% bonds. Because you really weren't going to live that long, statistically. That was 50 years ago. But now, people are retiring at 62, and instead of dying at 64, they're going back to work at 64 because they're bored. Or somebody made them an offer they couldn't refuse. Or they got this idea for a great business they want to start. And they're not dying until 98. Are you with me? You understand?
Yes, yeah.
So this formula, out the window. Poppycock, say others, myself included. But yeah, you like that word? Poppycock. I mean, I'll tell you, Alma, I'm 55. I should really have 45% in stocks, according to this rule, and 55% in bonds. And that's ridiculous. I'm not going to retire anytime soon. At least, I don't know, maybe they'll get rid of me. But I don't want to retire anytime soon. And when you do retire, you definitely need to be calmer. But I don't have 5% in bonds. I can't stand bonds. So there's many of us. We're not, remember, there's room for a disagreement, room for discussion. Many people in the industry say, this is ridiculous. Buy high-quality stocks, learn to put up with the volatility, arm yourself with information, look at the long term. Once you near retirement, okay, start buying bonds. You need that ballast, that airbag in case the world falls apart. Are you with me? Not every situation. What?
That part right there sounds like if you would take your assets, whatever you have, and then decide how to put it to work.
Yes.
To make sure the most.
Yes, we're going to show you. We're going to show you an example in a couple slides. Hang on a minute. Okay. How are we doing? Not bad. Not bad. Okay. So here it is, right here. Here's the next slide. Let's say $100,000 dumps into your lap. Not bad, huh?
Casino.
Did any of my students buy a lottery ticket last week?
No.
Of course not. You got one again.
What?
They made some rich. You didn't win.
You're not that lady that bought, that they bought a bunch for
Michelle.
I guess she, they all put in money and they bought a whole bunch.
And
one of the tickets actually won. And she said, she's like, no, that wasn't from the money you guys all put in. I bought that one separate on my own.
Oh.
Everyone put in $2 and bought a whole bunch. One of them won and she went, no, I put the money you guys gave me.
Is she dead? Funeral services are, what are the funeral services?
One of the tickets won, but she said that ticket she purchased on her own.
Dead woman walking. Dead woman walking.
What that teaches you is
when you're doing these what that teaches you is you don't do it. Okay?
No.
What?
Yeah.
She better have pretty good security.
Well, there was another guy, New York. He, taxi driver, he won the lottery.
Yay!
But it was with a pool of
A
pool of taxi drivers. And he quit the job and went into hiding. They found him. And they said, well, what's the result? And they found out he won. So they sued him. And the judge nailed him.
Oh, good. Good. Glad to hear it. Okay. So let's get the lottery. Forget the lottery. $100,000 falls in your lap. And so you're a fairly, conservative investor. You're young, though. You say, I'll put 25% in bonds and 75% in stocks. All right? Of those bonds, I'll put 15% of the total portfolio, $15,000, into high-grade corporate and government, like BBB, AAA. $5,000 into high-yield junk bonds, and you can use mutual funds, you don't have to buy individual bonds, and $5,000 into global bonds. Of the 75% that is stocks, I'll put 25% of the total into domestic growth and income, another 25% into global growth and income. I'm a big fan of growth and income. $10,000, there's my, spice, there's my jalapeno peppers, in aggressive growth. $10,000 international, and $5,000 in small company stocks. So you like it?
Yeah.
It's yours. Remembering that every person is different. But that's the idea. And so when you go back to that slide that showed the 25 years, every year, one of these things is going to do horrible. And every year, one of these things is going to do okay. Are you with me? Cool. Okay, good. Some of those same advisors that suggest asset allocation also suggest the technique of what is called rebalancing. Each year, once a year is enough, maybe twice a year, you check to see if your percentages are still in balance. If stocks have had a banner year, for example, your investment percentage might have gone up to 70% stocks and down to 30% bonds. You understand? Stocks did really well. Bonds just didn't do anything. So what do? Buy more stocks, right? No. You sell some of your stocks and you buy some more bonds, either through a mutual fund or, individual, to get yourself back into balance. Are you with me? Understand? Likewise, if stocks have tanked and bonds have done well, you sell some bonds, buy some stocks. Are you with me? Understand what's going on here? Now, why is this cool? Because it forces you to do the right thing. It forces you to buy low, sell high. Stocks have done well. You take out the emotion of, whoopee! Hey! Who wants to sell when the market's going up? Nobody, right? Except for smart people who take out the emotion. and say, all right, I've done well. It's time to take some money off the table. That's what people will say. Take some money off the table. Right. And, of course, if bonds have not done well, you're buying them when they're low. Now, is it a guarantee of success?
No.
In 1995 to 1999, every year, if you kept selling your stocks, they kept going up. Oh, well. But eventually, they did get hammered. In retirement, many advisors suggest that retirees shed the bulk of their stock investments in favor of bonds and cash investments. The only problem is people are living much, much longer. A 50-year-old living today has a 50-50 chance of living to see 100 years old. Now, that's a scary statistic. You millennials, 120, 130, should be typical. We don't know, because it's 80 years, 90 years from now. But given the medical technology advances and the fact that we know what keeps people alive, right? We know you've got to stay exercise, you've got to keep exercising no matter how old you are. You've got to keep that weight down. Slow down on the meat. Slow down on the carbonated sugar water with the brown crayon in it. And you don't smoke, certainly. And you should, statistically live a long time. It reminds me of cars. 50 years ago, if a car reached 100,000 miles, that was pretty darn amazing. It was very difficult for cars. Now, if you don't reach 100,000 miles on a new car, what does it mean? Yeah, some of them are still under warranty, right? You drained the oil and drove it around or whatever, you just didn't take care of it. And the same thing is true of people. If you millennials, if you don't, now obviously it's not perfect, because something you did when you were 2 years old could give you cancer when you're 60, whatever. So that's not a perfect analogy. Some chemical that you accidentally drank could have twisted your DNA in such a way that 60 years from now... You become Spider-Man, right, exactly. Yeah, yikes. Okay, good luck. As you near retirement, start migrating your investments from stocks to bonds, but don't abandon stocks entirely. And we're going to take a look at a couple of illustrations before we leave today that are on the website. Dollar cost averaging. Do I sound like a broken record? Dollar cost averaging. Have I said 50 bucks a month, 100 bucks a month, over and over again? A system of buying an investment at regular intervals with a fixed dollar amount. It's practically the only way most of us are going to invest, because most of us don't have $100,000 falling into our lap, do we? Maybe once in your lifetime it'll happen, but not often. So we are the ones, the grunts, who need to be putting 50 bucks, 100 bucks away. And the best thing about this, and I think I've told you, because this is from chapter 4, the cool thing about dollar cost averaging is there's always good news. No matter what happens when you wake up, I always tell my wife, I say, Anita, that's her name, Anita. I said, no matter what happens tomorrow, because at first I had to continue, she was always, this is a while ago, but she was always worried, why are we just investing in stocks? Why don't we invest in real estate? We own our own house. But why don't we buy a house? Because it's too damn expensive. And we can't even keep our own house together. We have to now keep somebody else's house together. We're going to rent it out. And so I tell her, I said, no matter what happens, even if the market goes down, if the there's good news tomorrow. The market's up. Good news.
Yippee.
Why? Because your account is worth more. The market's down. Good news. Yes, especially for the younger folks, you want the market to crash. Yeah, right. Because why? The next month, your 50 bucks, your 100 bucks are going to buy more shares. Make sense? If you're broke, you want the market to go down. So misery loves company. You want it to go down and then come back up again.
You want to crash.
Okay, so here. Back in chapter 4, I asked you to memorize this. I'm going to ask you again to memorize it, but not this one, the next slide. Here's an example. You invest $1,000 every year for 3 years. Okay, so this is very stark, but this is what happened in 2008. So the first year you put $1,000 in, and it was $10 a share. So how many shares did you get? 100. The next year it's dropped 50%, which was 2008, folks, and 1973 and 74 and 1929, where it dropped 80%. You put $1,000 in, add $5 a share, how many shares did you get? So now you have a cumulative total of 300 shares. The next year it's rebounded 50%. It's gone from $5 to $7.50, which is what happened in 2009. So now you have $1,000 at $7.50 a share, and you get 133.333 shares. Now, just looking at this, it looks as though you broke even, doesn't it? You bought at $10, $5, and $7.50. You made money. Huh? Because you bought more shares when the price was low. Your average cost per share is $6.92. 3,000 divided by 433.333 shares. But the price per share is $7.50. So although it looks as though you should have broken even, you should have simply broken even, you actually made money because you bought more shares at the lower price, fewer shares at the higher price. The value of your shares is $3,250. You see that? Is it a guarantee?
No.
No, it's not a guarantee. By always investing the same amount of money, you are purchasing more shares when the price is low and fewer shares when the price is high. So here's the takeaway. And I know people don't understand what dollar cost averaging means. It's a silly name. And they don't remember this. And then when they do remember, they don't understand unless they can work out that problem on the previous slide. Your average cost per share should be lower than your average price per share. Memorize that. So when someone says, well, why do you put $50 away? I like the dollar cost average because my average cost per share should be less than the average price per share. And they'll go, oh, that sounds nice. And then you show them the slide on the previous slide. You show them the graph and they go, oh, this is interesting. Did I say it's not a guarantee of success? I think I said that. But dollar cost averaging is not going to help a lousy investment turn a handsome profit. If it keeps going down, folks... Yeah,
probably.
But it does make investing very, very easy for the vast majority of us using mutual funds. It's a bit trickier with stocks and bonds. Why? Because you're not going to buy one stock at $25 with $50. You know, you have to pay commissions. So what people do is they get up $600,000, $700,000, $800,000. They build it up, you know, every month, $100 until they can get $1,000, and then they buy 7 shares or 10, 12 shares, because you're going to pay commission every time you buy the shares, you understand? There are some companies, and we talked about dividend reinvestment plans, that will let you put in $50 and they'll charge you, you know, 20 cents or something like that. So check those out. But those are dividend reinvestment plans. And of course, bonds, you know, $1,000 is the minimum, and they usually want $25,000. So it does make investing very easy for mutual fund investors. Speaking of mutual funds, wasn't diversification one of the two main reasons why so many investors choose mutual funds? Right? When you say, well, what was good about mutual funds? Diversification and professional money management. Does that mean that mutual funds necessarily have less risk than individual portfolios? Maybe. Exactly. It depends on the mutual fund. So we're going to go to Morningstar or Yahoo, and that's your assignment, to look at the risk profiles. We've looked at the returns of stocks, bonds, mutual funds that invest in stocks and bonds. Now let's start looking at the risk. And it's very easy, and that's your assignment. And that's Chapter 11. Cool? Yay. Okay, so now, was I right when I said it's sort of tied it all together? I hope so. If not, oh well, I apologize. Okay, so let's take a look at what mutual fund was that? That was Washington Mutual, I think. It doesn't matter. Got a mutual fund anybody interested in? That says stock. We can look at Home Depot, but that's a stock. It's going to have a different profile. Any Vanguards? Oh, let's take a look at the Vanguard 500 index, the investor shares. And that's going to basically be the standard. What we're looking at, folks, is the Standard and Poor's Standard and Poor's 500 index. So over here, you notice risk. You see that guy right there? Risk. Bingo. Okay. And so the risk has several types. The one we're interested in is standard deviation. And what they do is they try to compare it against its category. Well, the category, in this case, should be large cap U.S. stocks. Notice the R-squared, that's the correlation coefficient, against the standard index, which is the Standard & Poor's 500. It's 100%. Why? Because this thing invests in the Standard & Poor's 500. So the correlation should be 100%, unless, you know, they don't actually pick the same stocks. That's unusual, but not unusual for an index fund. What was the standard deviation over the last, 10 years? Oh, 3 years. Let's look at 10 years. What's the standard deviation for the Standard & Poor's 500 over the last 10 years? 16. So 16% up or down from the average annual return of about 4%. The category as a whole has even been more risky. Not much more, but riskier. Are you with me? Understand what we're talking about now? And then I'm going to ask you to look up alpha and beta and a few, if you want to, Sharpe and Trainer. They're measurements of risk. Imperfect. But now let's take a look at a mutual fund that invests in the category of large cap funds. And this is one of my favorites. It's called American Funds, Washington Mutual Fund. And I'm not, this is not meant to be a recommendation. And what we see, What we see is that this is a different category. They're giving this a different category. They're not giving it the same category that we saw in the previous. I don't know why. This should be the same category. I guess they're narrowing this category. They're probably even calling this large cap value, large cap domestic value, as opposed to just large cap domestic. If this is considered a value fund, they invest in deep value, they sometimes call them. And so, 14.49, 16.27. What does that tell us?
That our standard deviation is not...
That this mutual fund varied less than the category as a whole.
That's good.
Is that good?
I would say so.
10 years?
No, not really.
Yeah. 10 months or 3 months? Yeah, I'll agree with you. But 10 years. So this is one of those types of mutual funds that emphasizes not only return, but also emphasizes minimizing risk. You understand?
Yes.
Now, what I'm going to ask you to do is compare the return against the category. And what are you going to say? Less risk?
Return.
Yeah, right.
I guess I just want to see how one index fund should drastically be different than any other index fund if they're based on the same index.
No, why? Fees. It's the fee, unless they screw up, unless they don't know what you're doing.
And our fees are especially low, right?
Right, and you go look at that Nationwide. I don't know if you saw my rant in Chapter 4, where I went off on Southwestern Community College's 403B. They didn't realize. I don't know if did I tell you this? They moved it internal. Before, you used to go out and find a broker and find a company to deal with, and then they moved it inside. And you just know, folks, if you, an insurance company is the third-party administrator, is the people sponsoring your 401k plan, know that they're screwing it. Just bend over because you get lots of loop because they're going to... And so we had this meeting. There was about 40 of us sitting in there, and they didn't realize there was a ringer at me up in the front. I always sit in the front. And they're showing these mutual funds. They had some 70 mutual funds, which is, first of all, stupid. You should have fewer. Remember the thrift savings plan?
Mm-hmm.
Has 5. And it turns out when you give employees fewer choices, they are better able to make a decision, and they're better and they more will contribute. They'll participate more. So they had these Gartmore, Galtmore, whatever they were, index funds, and they're like 0.8, 0.75%. And what's the Standard & Poor's 500 index for Vanguard? 0.17. And then you get over 10,000, it goes down to 0.6, 0.6 or something, 0.7, 0.07, 0.06. I mean, nothing compared to this bozo, which was 10 times more. And so I said, wait a minute, how come this Standard & Poor's 500 index fund has an expense ratio of 75 basis points, 0.75%. I didn't say 75 basis points. Then he would have known that I knew what I was talking about. And he goes, yeah, we're looking to get a different one. That's a little high. Yeah, you're right. We're looking to get a different one. Why don't you have Vanguard? Oh, they charge a lot more. We mean they charge a lot more. Hey, that's the problem. The Gardmore index fund was taking, 25 basis points or 0.25% or whatever and giving it to the brokers as a kickback. So they got rid of it and they put their own nationwide Standard & Poor's 500 index, which has 0.7 something or other. So they get to keep all of it. And that's why when you walk into that 401k meeting, you're going to look like a genius. Because you're going to ask the same kind of question I asked when those bozos in the three-piece suits with the Armani and the Fucci and the whatever it is, what's it called? Gucci, right. And they, I don't know why they call it our money. Once you give it them, it's their money. I don't know why.
Our money.
Yeah, our money. It could be their money. Okay, questions, thoughts? You like that one? Okay, cool. All right, now, next. Over here. Here are some... why did I put bonds first? I should have put stocks in retirement. Let's say you retired. And you've got a nest egg. And how much is it? How much is your nest egg?
$1.7 million.
Lucky you. Let's say it's $200,000. Because that's not unusual, folks, for people to have a couple hundred thousand in their... What? Well, if you start now, it will be. But many of the people who are looking at retirement started in their 40s or 50s. Because they finally got her, you better get started now, what should they do? And some of them haven't put away a dime. A lot of baby boomers have not put away a dime. I put away more than a dime. But you got to remember, I only make 17 and a half cents an hour. So last time I checked, I think it was about 30 bucks in there.
17 and a half.
Isn't that how much we make here? 17 and a half? Okay, so anyway, you put $200,000, but you put it into a stock mutual fund. Well, now, wait a minute. Would most people do that in retirement? 200 grand in the stock mutual fund and hold on to it? So you're, say, 65 years old. And you take 5% out a year, right? You're going to take 5% out every year. And as the... that's me again? I have to get rid of this thing. To figure out how to use it, actually. As you go along, here's the money you're withdrawing. You're using it as income in retirement. So every year you're going to recalculate. Now maybe the market goes up, maybe the market goes down. So you're going to recalculate your income. And not only are you going to take 5%, but also, is it 5% or is it 4? Let me see what I did here. Let me see. Yeah. Withdraw. I'm sorry, 4%. Can you take a joke? We're taking 4% out every year, and we're increasing that by 3%, not 4, 7, 10. No. Say we took out 4%, whatever that amount was, the next year we're going to increase it by 3%, the amount that we took out. And every year we'll recalculate based on the new value of the portfolio because the market goes up and down. And what we see is that stocks normally give us rising income. There's the growth aspect. So here we're in our 60s and you see our income is doing very well. Why? The 1990s were a great time for stocks. And our portfolio is going up. And we hit the year 2000 at 474,000. But now what happened to the market over the next 2 years? It went down. And we're 75 now? Are we willing to accept that fall? And our income drops substantially. But let's say we stuck it out. What happens in the year 2003? It starts to rebound. Until we hit 2007, we're making $30,000 from this portfolio in terms of withdrawals. And our portfolio has hit $473,000. And then 2008 happens. And now, how old are we? we're getting close to 80. If not, we're at 80. And so we died because we have a heart attack when we open up and look at the statement. Because it went from 472 to 286. Ouch. You see what kind of what volatility can do for us? Do to us in retirement. But we hang on and we see that it starts to come back, but we're, you know, remember we're taking money out and this is only for a couple of months. They haven't gotten the data yet for March yet. But this is only 2 months. But we're back up. We hit 716,888, but now our income is coming back up. But it's a far cry from 30,000 a year. But look at our nest egg. It's still 350,000. That's not bad, is it? And we've made 9.83%. Questions? Thoughts?
Are you making it big?
80. We're 85 years old now. Statistically, we have another 10 years to go. 8, 9, 10 years. Statistically, we might have longer. And you, if you stop eating that red meat, you might live to 120 or 30. Okay, so now, let's say our brother-in-law, the Mr. Know-It-All, told us, what are you doing? You're nuts. You need to put all your money when you're in retirement into bonds. So we did the same thing. We started with 300,000. 4% annually, every year we recalculate and raise it by 3%, the amount. And so we start with about the same amount of income. But we find that the income is going up far slower, and our total portfolio is going up far slower. And did we get hammered in 2000 to 2002? No. Not really. In fact, we wound up going up. Because interest rates came down, bond prices, and then we start the long march until 2007 when we get hit by 2008, but as badly as stocks got hit? No. But notice, well, we forgot to, there was about 400,000 of, we have to go back and look at what our withdrawals were, but we withdrew a total of 255,000 and our nest egg is down to 217. We wound up with a total return of 6.38%. So let's go back real fast. I should have done that. Why did you do this to me, you jerk? Okay, the stocks gave us 387. Remember that number. They gave us 387 in income. That's with a K. And we're left with 349, our nest egg. But we had to put up with a whole lot more volatility. The bonds gave us 255 in terms of income, and our nest egg is at 218. Now, what happens if we blend the two? What do you think is going to happen? We should see something in between these two with less volatility, but because of 2008, it still looks ugly. So let's go up. Same idea. We're going to start with $200,000 and start taking withdrawals. And as we, every year we rebalance. Our income is rising. Our portfolio is rising. Does 2002 hit us hard? 2000, it hit us, but actually less overall. I'm sorry, no, not less overall. It hit us harder than bonds. But much less overall than stocks. And our income takes a little bit of a hit in 2002, rises again, and in 2008, from 359 to 243, not as bad as the stock portfolio, but a whole lot worse than the bond portfolio. We have a total of 321,000 in income. So in between the two, as we expected, and our nest egg is at 283,500, and our return was 8.27%. So what does this tell you? Yes.
These are non-adjusted numbers for inflation.
No, these are not adjusted for inflation. But we essentially adjusted for inflation because every year we increase our withdrawal by 3%. Understand? So if we took 10, what does that mean? If we took $10,000 out last year, We made 10,300. We took out 10,300. On top of whatever changes we made because our portfolio went up or down. Yes?
I think that's fine.
So that basically adjusts for inflation. So are you going to give up on stocks entirely in in retirement? But are you going to have all stocks in retirement?
No.
Maybe. Probably not, because it gives yourself a heart attack. All right, so now, what do you think? We're done.
Awesome.
We are essentially done. But we got to learn about stock options. And we got to learn about shorting and margining, because this is an introduction to investment planning, and you have to know it. But for next week on the exam, bonds, bond calculations, what we discussed here, maybe one question about hybrids, what are hybrids, preferred stock, convertible bonds. Tuesday, next to sit down, please sit down.
Getting a question.
Those of you who want to stick around and do a couple of calculations, do maybe the constant perpetual dividends earnings model or any of the bond calculations, I'll stay here. I'll have to go change my office hour and see if I can move it to here. And so, otherwise, study hard. Bring honor and glory to Southwestern Community College next week. Do really well on the exam. Okay. Many graces.
Oh, yeah.
Gracias.
We have the Navy.
Navy SEALs?
Yeah.
What are they going to be?